And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in the clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and we're coming at you live like every Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. We have another great show for you tonight. Our guest this evening is Ryan Mullahy. He was on several episodes ago, I think maybe episode 88, talking about a particular case. He's a writer and a UFO researcher, and we're going to talk about different aspects of the UFO field this evening. And I've gotten to know Ryan, and he has a lot of integrity, and he and I are, you know, kind of speak the same language when it comes to UFOs. So it should be a good show tonight. Most of you probably heard that our regular guest, Stanton T. Friedman, had a heart attack, and I've been communicating with his very close friend, Kathleen Marden, and her direct quote is, quote, "Stan had a mild heart attack on Friday night. He's now feeling chipper and resting in the hospital while he awaits further testing. His doctors have advised him to rest and recuperate, so he's had to cancel his upcoming engagements in Roswell, New Mexico, and in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And we're all pulling for you, Stan, and we need you in this field, so have yourself a speedy recovery." And on an even sadder note, I hate to bring up sad news, but a guest that I really enjoyed last year, Terry Hansen, he was rather on the young side. And he passed away from a massive coronary, in his sleep last Thursday on June 26. Researcher Robert Hastings is a very good friend of Terry's, and he wrote me that, quote, "Terry was a pioneer and a first-class act," unquote. He was mostly noted for his book, The Missing Times. And, again, I really enjoyed him on the show. I wanted him back. And here's just a quick clip to give you a sample. You can actually listen to the podcast. It's linked to our show notes right on our homepage. Here's a quick clip of Terry.
The general impression that you got from reading the tabloids and looking at the tabloids was that, UFOs were kind of a trashy, disreputable subject. And that, of course, is exactly what the Robertson panel said it wanted to do. So I think there's a pretty good trail of evidence there that the National Enquirer was covering the UFO topic because of Gene Pope's affiliation with the Central Intelligence Agency.
Yeah, that was Terry Hansen, and Terry, may you rest in peace. Now we have another clip from Andy Fleming, Life on, boy, you know, I don't know how you say this. It's Enceladus. It's the moon on Jupiter, and it's a real interesting topic, and here is Andy's clip right here.
Hi, Martin and listeners. Well, the possible haunts of ET, or at least extraterrestrial microbes, are moving further out into our solar system, from Mars to Jupiter and its moon Europa to Saturn's Titan, and most recently to its icy moon Enceladus. This enigmatic little world is the sixth largest of Saturn's 62 moons and was discovered in 1789 by William Herschel. NASA's Cassini spacecraft has made several flybys of the 500-kilometre diameter moon over the last 10 years and has discovered plumes of water vapour erupting into space. These emanate from fractures and striations around the South Pole that planetary scientists have called tiger stripes. Over the eons, the ejected material from this so-called cryovolcanism has created Saturn's beautiful E-ring. Cassini has actually tasted one of the plumes, and after a fly-through, scientific analysis showed that the geysers on Enceladus contain organic molecules. Although these are not alive in themselves, they are based on carbon chemistry. Now, last April, NASA announced the startling discovery that there's an ocean up to 10 kilometres in depth and the size of Lake Superior at the moon's south pole. This is the location of the majority of the geysers and is a result of the friction and heat generated by Saturn's immense gravitational tidal forces. Now, this, of course, raises the tantalising possibility of extraterrestrial life on Enceladus. Astrobiologists state that the main requirements of life are water, energy, and chemical nutrients. All of these are present on the Moon. Many are now citing Enceladus as a better candidate for the discovery of life than Europa, due to its thin crust and outgassing of water vapour.
Well, he says geysers, we say geysers in the U.S., but you know what? I bet those Brits are right. They're probably saying it the right way. We're murdering their language as usual. And so right now, I want to thank you, Andy, but if you're listening live, please jump in our chat room and you can interact with us and actually ask our guests some questions. So you just need to go to podcastufo.com and right on our sidebar, it's a quick sign-in. And how are you, Ryan?
How you doing, Mars? Thanks for having me again.
Yes, I really enjoyed having you on last time, and been fun talking to you since in between. And you have a conference coming up that you're going to be at in Exeter, New Hampshire. Can you quickly throw that out there?
Sure. I'm going to be at the 2014 Exeter UFO Festival, which is in Exeter, New Hampshire. And this is going to be the fifth year. It would have been the sixth year, but last year, unfortunately, lightning struck the Exeter Town Hall, and they were unable to do the repairs in time. So this year will be the fifth year, and it's a really great event. It's one of the only free UFO festivals, I think, in the country that I know of, and it's sponsored by the Kiwanis. And they sell food and they sell T-shirts, and all that money goes to local charities. So it's really good because all of the profits go to charity. And there's family events, but there's also serious lectures from researchers such as myself, and then Stanton Friedman and Richard Dolan will be speaking, as well as a few other people. So it's a really nice event.
Yeah, Richard will be there. I'm going to get to meet him there. That'll be good. I'm going to be there. I'm going to have a table there. So any of the listeners that are in the New England area or want to have a real fun time and you want to come out and visit us, I will be set up with a table there and going to be interviewing a few guests, Richard Dolan, yourself, and hopefully Stanton will be able to attend that one.
Hopefully, yeah. I heard what happened, and definitely send my best to him. I hope he gets well soon.
Yeah, that's right. You know, last weekend, Ryan, we talked briefly. Last weekend, I was out in Chicago, and I do another show. I don't know how many listeners out there know that I do another show, but I do a show on antiques. I grew up all around antiques and antiques and fine art, and so I was out in Chicago doing a show on antiques, and I got done, and I got up the courage, as I was pretty comfortable with the panel of five people there, and I said, what do you guys think about UFOs? And, you know, their replies were typical for, you know, the ridicule-based world out there. So I'm going to play that clip right now.
What is your opinion on UFOs?
I don't know. You really caught me with my pants down around my ankles, but they might exist. But I'm a believer in anything. You could sell me anything.
Okay. Did you ever hear about the O'Hare Airport incident in 2006?
No, and I go to O'Hare a lot, but
there was something hovering over gate
C17. You sure it wasn't a stalled plane? I mean,
no,
they stack them up pretty deep out at O'Hare.
All observers saw it. And
my mind is open to anything.
I guess I just wonder if they're antiquers or not.
They eat antiques.
I have enough trouble dealing with what I can see and what I know. in retail all my life. Need I say more?
That's it? Okay.
Oh, Harry.
Harry on UFOs.
And I've been in Roswell, New Mexico, and I know they exist.
Have you really been there? Have you
yes.
been there? All right.
What was that? I cannot possibly believe we're the only things on around. I can't believe that. I really can't. They're there. But they're friendly.
So that was it. So, Ryan, what's your comments on, you know, the sort of a mixed group? You just throw the topic in there. And I like the guy that says, I'm open-minded. You could sell me on anything.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, my thoughts are, I mean, I thought that was, you know, for just throwing it out there, I thought that was a pretty, you know, positive response overall. You know, everybody seemed pretty open-minded to the possibility. So, a bit more positive sometimes than when you just throw it out there to, a random group of people. Typically, you tend to get more opposing views on the subject, so...
Yeah, and, I also thought the woman who said, I have a hard time dealing with what I can see, you know, I thought that was a pretty typical and, you know, probably across the board what, you know, a lot of people feel like, oh, my God, don't add that to my life. I already have too much going on, you know?
Definitely, yeah. I think sometimes unless, you know, you've had a sighting yourself or for whatever reason you develop a deep interest in the subject, a lot of times it falls into that category for people where, you know, they may be interested or open, but they're just, you know, busy living their lives, doing things, so they're just not, you know, into looking to it personally.
Yeah, so you were on quite a while ago, several months ago. So just for a quick recap, can you tell the listening audience who you are? And I know you had a couple sightings. So can you just talk, you know, kind of briefly about all that?
Sure. So basically, in the late 90s, I had a UFO sighting in New Hampshire. And after I had the sighting, you know, I just was pretty blown away. And, you know, I wanted to try and find as much information I could find on UFO sightings in New Hampshire and, you know, New England in general. So that's how I got started doing my research. And, you know, as I went on, I just, you know, found a lot of really interesting cases. And I just found that New Hampshire had a really interesting UFO history. Obviously, the Inson Exeter case and Betty and Barney Hill are two, you know, cases that come to mind right away, but there's also a lot of really great other cases that are, you know, lesser known. So the more I started looking into the subject, you know, because of my own sighting, I just started getting into the history of the UFO phenomenon in New Hampshire, and, you know, the more I went on, that became my focus. So in 2011, I started New Hampshire UFO Research, which basically what I do is I research the history of the UFO phenomena in New Hampshire, and I've written research articles on it, and I'm also working on a new website where it'll be a research-based website where people can go and they can access a lot of the research that I've, you know, retrieved myself and use that as a tool.
Now, do you source your findings?
Oh, as far as my articles?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I always have a reference list at the bottom. Yes, I always list my sources. And
you know, one of the things that we talked about last time, and just for the person that didn't listen, actually, we have a lot more new listeners since you were on last time. You are kind of the person that uncovered this when that was floating around the internet saying the earliest UFO picture in the world. You kind of uncovered that it was some type of structure in the snow that made it look like a cloud. That was pretty great. That was pretty good.
And go on.
That was a stereo, what's called in the antique world, here I am again, a stereo opticon view card. And what it is, it's a stereo card. So when you look at it in these glasses, it's kind of like the 3D. It actually gives a 3D effect.
Exactly.
And do you want to talk about uncovering that? Just, I know some listeners have already heard that, but
sure.
Just briefly what you did.
Yeah, sure. Basically, it was just a picture that, you know, surfaced in the early 2000s, and, you know, I was always fascinated by it, but the picture itself was a cropped version of the photo that you're referring to, which was the stereoscopic photo, so you didn't get the full perspective of the original photo by this, you know, the photo that was first circulating when it was claimed to be a UFO. So over the years, you know, I was always fascinated by it, and you know, I go back to it, and eventually I came across an article that named the actual photographers who took the photos. So that kind of gave me more to search with, because now I had the names of the photographers. So I was able to find that the New York Public Library had a set of these stereo photos, and they had the original photo. And, you know, once you view that photo, you can see the full photo in the perspective, and, you know, it becomes very clear that it's an object on the snow on the surface of Mount Washington. Now, I can't take all the credit for it because, you know, this photo's fascinated a number of people, and there's been a number of blog posts and, you know, forum posts about it, and, you know, which I do reference in my article. So, you know, basically what I did is once I found those photos, it became very apparent that it was not an object in the sky. And then through some of the clues that other people had listed, there's a book, for example, on the expedition that talks about the photography pretty in depth. So that was a really good piece of evidence because there was no mention of, you know, any sort of strange things in the sky from the photographers. And there was also a list with all the names of the photographs. And the name of the photograph was listed as Frost Architecture. And if you look at this particular photo, it looks like, you know, a frost structure on the surface of Mount Washington with some unknown object in the center of it. So that's basically, you know, just from doing some research and, you know, looking for different evidence and, you know, referencing some other people that did some good work, I just kind of brought it all together because, you know, I found that there's still a lot of sites, even till now, there's still a lot of sites that haven't taken this photo down and haven't acknowledged, you know, the things that I brought forward. So it's just a good example of how sometimes in ufology, when something takes hold, it's you really got to kind of get people's attention to try and get things, you know, corrected.
That's right, and that's going to be a lot about our topic tonight, those type of things. You know, for instance, the UFOs and religious paintings have, you know, more or less been debunked, and there's reasons behind all that, and you can see that, you know, I'm not one to jump on anyone's debunking bandwagon, but after I watched these videos on YouTube, basically very scientifically debunking what these images are that were painted, these iconic images, what appears to be like a flying saucer, was typical in painting. I encourage people to check that out on YouTube. There's a guy that really takes his time. He's not mean in any type of way. He just explains what these things are. But if you go on the Internet right now, all over the Internet, you'll find images and actually in some documentaries, too, that show these so-called UFOs in early Renaissance paintings. We have the message board going here, and anyone can jump over on it if you're listening live. Just go to podcastufo.com. It's right on the sidebar. Real easy sign-in. And we have a question up there now. Does Ryan know of any ancient or historic American Indian legends of UFOs or ET in the New Hampshire or northern New England region?
Well, there, you know, I've done a bit of reading up on that, and it's a little bit difficult because the way the Indians would, you know, kind of refer to different things and phenomenon was based a lot on their belief system, and you know, so there were things that I came across in New Hampshire and Maine that, you know, weren't blatant, you know, we saw a UFO, but, you know, were things where they saw glowing, I think they called them carbuncles on mountains and, you know, things where there shouldn't be light. So I have come across, you know, some stuff like that, but nothing really ultra concrete specific to, you know, UFOs.
Yeah. No, you've never heard of like any drawings on rocks like they have, like say in Arizona. I think there's actually some in Massachusetts.
Yeah, not. I haven't heard of anything specific to UFOs in New Hampshire.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, we're going to talk a little bit about abductions later, but right now I wanted to talk about, you know, sort of what it's like trying to police these type of situations that get out of hand. And, you know, it's to police them, it's good for everybody. And I'm actually pretty excited because on July 29th on our show then, I have a girl that calls herself Sheila Aliens. She's a young girl, probably in her 20s. And she has been calling out people that are scamming on YouTube with hoax videos. I mean, she takes them on, you know, head on. And there's actually a great Skype interview of her head to head with the guy from Third Phase of the Moon. She's calling him out on all his hoaxes, and it is the hoaxes that hoaxes and the myths that get carried away that muddy the waters and make it more difficult for the real researchers, the people that take this serious, to gain any ground. And you've been involved in some things that go along those lines. I'm not sure if you want to talk about any specifics, but that's more or less your thoughts.
Yeah, I don't know that I want to get into anything specific, but, you know, I think that, you know, I think those situations, you know, they do arise from time to time. And, you know, I think it's important, you know, where this subject is, you know, it's, there's a lot of ridicule and doubt behind it. And, you know, it also, you know, due to its ambiguous nature, it can attract people that, you know, maybe don't have the best intentions, or they see the opportunity to take advantage of it because it is an ambiguous thing. So I think it's important to call people out. You know, if you see something that isn't right or inaccurate, you know, I think it's really important to do that. You know, but it's a double-edged sword, because then at the same token, you know, it's very easy to get caught up in the, you know, the ufological, you know, back and forth, infighting and things like that. That I try to avoid. But I think it's important, you know, if something's inaccurate or you see something, you know, that's deceptive, it's important to, you know, politely point it out for the greater good.
Yeah, because, you know, what happens as time goes on, if there's something that's, you know, misquoted or something that is an entire myth that said over and over again, the next thing you know, it sort of becomes part of the story. And it's awful hard to shake. Now, we had someone on the forum message board recently that was really going at one of our past guests, because he mentioned, I'm not going to get into the specifics of it, but the past guest that I had mentioned a situation with timing of a witness that was on one show a number of years ago. And then when he was on my show, he was calling it as fact, and that that really upset this guy. So, and that's what happens, because, you know, a lot of these myths can actually turn into believable facts, and they get printed in books. And next thing you know, they're, you know, on TV. People are watching it and, you know, swallowing it. And it's really difficult, you know. For instance, Roswell, I'm sure that's a mixture of a lot of myths along with a lot of really hard facts, and it's hard to tell what's real and what's not anymore.
I agree. And, you know, that's part of what I've tried to do, you know, with my research is, you know, a lot of these New Hampshire cases, you know, two or three come to mind. The oldest known UFO photo is one. There's a few others. You know, these are cases that I just was initially looking at because I was fascinated by them. And in my investigation or research into them, you know, I should say, that's when, you know, things started to surface that called them into question. So, you know, for me, it's always just about trying to find the best information. And, you know, that's when I first had my sighting, I found it very hard to, you know, get good information. And, you know, there's all these people with books and, you know, who's credible, who isn't, you know. So, you know, that's why what I'm trying to do for New Hampshire is to just go through all the available stuff and really take a look. And if there's, you know, anything new that I can come up with, or if something doesn't, you know, quite pan out, you know, just point it out and let people, you know, make the decision for themselves. I try not to, you know, make any final determinations on things, but merely just present what I found and, you know, let the reader decide for themselves.
Right. Right. One of the things I wanted to touch on briefly is, you mentioned Betty and Barney Hill, and you know, the abduction thing. When I first I had a sighting, and when I first started doing the show, I kind of promised myself, well, I'm going to stay away from abductions entirely. You know, that's just too much, too iffy. But then I started thinking about things like, you know, the Betty and Barney Hill case, and how believable most of that is. And then I remember the Allagash case, which was our show last week, you know, from way back. I just remember briefly hearing about it. And then, you know, Travis Walton, you know, there's some so solid cases. And to, for me to actually interview these people, sit across from the table and look them in the eye while they're telling their story, and not feeling a bit like any of it is conjectured at all, it really kind of moves me. And I had to jump off that fence and just say, well, you know, if I saw something that can't be explained, whether it's from another planet or not, I have no idea. But if I actually buy into that, you know, who's driving these things? And you know, are there more things being done? I currently have, I feel like I'm talking a little too much tonight. I'm sorry about that, listeners. But I feel like I have a hard time with, like, these millions of people that are saying they're abducted. But, you know, I don't know. I can't say for sure.
I agree. You know, I guess I feel similar about that. You know, the more, you know, you look at certain abduction cases, you know, there's a lot of credible people involved in some of them. You know, Betty and Barney Hill is a perfect example. You know, their credibility is impeccable as far as citizens and, you know, in their work and just in their community. So, you know, I think we're similar in that regard where I've always been very skeptical of abduction, but there are some cases that I feel like the people are very credible and, you know, I don't see much reason for them to you know, to kind of put themselves out there, especially in the case of, you know, Betty and Barney Hill, where they were well-known in the community. They were an interracial couple in New Hampshire in the early 60s. There, you know, there's a lot of, they both had good jobs. There, you know, there's a lot of reasons why they wouldn't want to bring that sort of attention on themselves. So, you know, to me, their credibility and those sort of things, you know, I think, you know, makes me really think that those cases, you know, do have the potential to be good cases.
Yeah, I know you don't, you know, you mentioned on our private conversation you weren't ready to jump in full blast into the abduction, you know, cases. But if let's just say ETs were abducting humans, have you ever thought of why they'd be doing it? Has that ever crossed your mind? That's actually, I'm sort of reading off the message board a question.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, just before I answer that, you know, as far as, you know, what I've done with New Hampshire UFO research, where I, you know, I'm specific to New Hampshire, I've looked, you know, at the Betty and Barney Hill case a great deal and abductions that have been claimed to happen in New Hampshire. So I have looked at them to a certain degree, but as far as my personal research, you know, I've chosen to, you know, to focus more on cases with police and military and, you know, things with more tangibles involved. But that's not because I don't think abduction is a valid area of research. It's just, for my personal interest, you know, it just falls in that area a bit more. So, I'm sorry, what was the question again? I forgot. I'm sorry.
Yeah. What would be the purpose of the abductions, you know, that the ETs were doing, if it were ETs?
You know, I can only theorize, you know, and there's been a lot of theories thrown around. You know, some of my theories of why people are abducted, you know, possibly checking environmental things with the Earth as far as, you know, whether we're absorbing chemicals or, you know, it could be things of that nature, our evolution. You know, there could be any number of things if there are indeed people abducting, you know, people. There could be a number of things. So, I mean, I'm pretty wide open on it. You know, I think that if there are people, you know, abducting people on Earth, I think that there's any number of, you know, scientific reasons that they would be doing that.
Right, right. Someone just alerted me to another way to look at questions here through the Dark Matter hashtag on Twitter. So I just was totally distracted there for a second. So a thought occurred to me while you were talking a minute ago there. I wonder if there are any cases of actual police officers or, you know, someone in that level that claim to be abducted. Are you aware of anything like that?
I am not aware of anything like that. The only cases, you know, other than the New Hampshire cases, you know, talking kind of countrywide. You know, I know I've heard of a few cases where cops have encountered things in their police car, and you know, the cars have been damaged. There's been some alleged physical damage, but yeah, no, I've never. There very well could be, but I haven't heard of one.
Yeah, yeah, that would be interesting to find out. You know, I know this Lonnie Zamora out in New Mexico. You know, back way back in the 60s. And by the way, Ray Stanford, who wrote The Socorro Flying Saucer years ago, he was the first investigator besides Alan J. Hynek on the case. He was there, and he's going to be on our show in just a few weeks. It'll be good to have him on.
Oh, wow. That'll be a great guest.
Yeah. He hasn't done too many, so. So we're not going to go, you know, deep into the abduction cases, but you know, I do kind of question, it just seems like there's, is it possible that all these people that are claiming they're abducted, and we're talking in the tens of thousands and around the United States, maybe even, you know, some people are claiming that it might be up to a million people. I don't know if you've ever heard that, but
I hadn't heard that number. No.
Yeah. have you ever heard of Yvonne Smith?
I have not.
Yeah, she's out in California. She was actually on Coast to Coast the other night, and she is someone that does hypnotic regressions. So she's going to be on our show in August as well. And I talked to her when I was out in California last fall, and sat and talked with her and tried to record a session with her, but we had some very strange things happen in her studio, and the thing did not come out. There was this is such a bizarre thing. I almost hate to talk about it, but when I played the thing back, there was like chanting, and
wow.
I could not edit it out. And so I called her up and I says, you know, that show we did together is no good. We can't use it. And she asked why, and I said the chanting. She goes, oh, that again, or something like that.
Wow, that's weird.
Yeah, it's absolutely bizarre. So, but anyway. Let's talk about in New Hampshire, since you're focusing on that. You're saying that there's you'd like to stick to the police and military. Are there some military cases? I'm just not aware of any.
Well, you know, I mean, I do look at pretty any, you know, anything from New Hampshire, but I like those cases because, you know, there's Project Blue Book documents, there's, you know, there's newspaper articles, there's, you know, there's things that you can go and retrieve. So I find that I like those. You know, there's, besides the incident in Exeter, which is involved the police, obviously, in Exeter, New Hampshire, there's quite a few that were a part of the Blue Book files that had to do with Pease Air Force Base. So there are quite a few there.
You know, I have a longtime friend, a family friend, that ended up in the area because he was stationed at Pease for many, many years. And he worked actually in a family business that my father had. And so I got to know him real well. And he's like now in his, he's in his mid 70s. And I saw him a few months ago and I said to him, hey Joe, while you were at Pease, did anyone ever talk about UFOs? And he said, he looked at me, his eyes kind of bugged out, and he said, no. So I think that's total disinformation.
Yeah, that's funny. It's funny. But, yeah, there was, you know, what's interesting is that at the time Roswell happened, the 509th Bomb Group was stationed at Roswell, which is, mm-hmm. you know, the most elite bomb group. They dropped the nuclear bombs. And in 1958, they moved from Roswell to Pease Air Force Base.
Ah.
So that's an interesting connection there that, you know, from that point forward from 58, the 509th Bomber Group was there. And, you know, there's a number, if you go over the Blue Book cases, a number of actual, where there were radar hits. On one case I've been looking at where there was up to 18 unknown radar targets, and jets were scrambled. They were registered on three different radar systems. And, you know, Blue Book, which, unless, you know, a lot of people may not know, a lot of time they kind of assigned explanations to some of the, you know, a lot of the cases that weren't necessarily the most scientific explanations. And, you know, in this case, you know, there was 18 unknown targets. Some of them were changing direction. Some of them flew to the coast, then went back out to the water. And, you know, they were traveling at a good rate of speed. And ultimately, Blue Book, you know, said that they were just false targets. And, you know, it was completely feasible for there to be 15 false targets. But, you know, a lot of times the determinations from Blue Book, it doesn't really jive with the initial, you know, reports. So, you know, it's a little tough with those because where, you know, a lot of the Blue Book determinations, they're, you know, they're saying, oh, it's weathers, it's stars, it's planets, it's false targets. You know, it's tough, but, you know, the data is pretty compelling.
Right. When I grew up, I lived in a little town called Elliott, Maine, and we were up on a hill, and across the river, we could very clearly see the whole landing strip of Pease. And let me tell you, there was always weird things going on. I mean, my sisters and I would sit on top of the hill and just look out and watch over there, you know, because, you know, we could see, you know, what looked like weird planes. I've seen weather balloons over there. And I remember, you know, when F-16, I think it was, crashed over there. You know, we saw the whole thing. I mean, the house shook and everything. We ran outside and a big, you know, ball of flame over there. But I always felt that Pease was it was just weird. I just had this feeling it was a weird place to live near.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, you know, the proximity to Pease, there's been a lot of, you know, there's been a lot of sightings there, you know, since the 60s and, you know, throughout. So, it definitely is a, you know, it's an interesting area, and it has a lot of history, you know, if you read up on it, as far as the military and, you know, I believe presidents have landed there. I believe that's typically where they fly in. And they actually are doing some, I just read they're doing some renovations, so it's, you know, it's not as active as it was before, but it's still, you know, a highly used airstrip. So,
where can you give a general? We have on the chat room. We have some local people to us. It's always fun to watch what people type in where they're from. We have someone in New Hampshire. What's the general area of New Hampshire you live in?
That I live in?
Yeah.
Peterborough.
Oh, Peterborough, New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. Okay. How about that? And someone else is in Maine. You know, I live in, well, west of the Portland, Maine area, basically. Mm-hmm. And so getting back to the message board here, there is a question for you. If UFOs were acknowledged, what effect would that have on the average American? These are just, you know, like opinion questions.
Sure. Yeah. I don't know. You know, I think it's tough to say. I think it would be different for everybody. I think it, you know, depends on how open-minded they are, what their personal religious beliefs are. I think it would affect everybody different. Although I think, you know, with all of these possible habitable planets that have been found in the last 3 years, I think people just almost subliminally are starting to get a little bit more open to it. Maybe people that weren't, you know, I think that's been kind of a, you know, a quiet thing that's gone on that I think, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, UFOs seen around, you know, Earth are aliens flying through space. But, you know, I think just the having people shown that, hey, there's a lot of planets out here that could harbor life, I think it's harder for people to kind of ridicule about that, you know. So I guess I think it would affect everybody different. I think people would be very curious about it, you know. So I think there'd be a lot of curiosity.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're right. I think we're really heading toward more of, you know, of a place where people will accept, if it ever is, you know, hard facts. I think they'll accept it a lot easier. Because of that, kind of like the clip I played earlier and the people I just threw that on in Chicago, you know, the woman saying, you know, I would be foolish to think that we're the only things alive out here, you know, and I agree.
Mm. Yeah, I agree as well.
Okay, another one here. What are your thoughts? No, I'm not screening these. I'm just reading them as I see them. So you guys better be nice on the chat room. Oh, so what are your thoughts on human mutilation reports?
You know, that, I mean, it's something that I've always been fascinated about when I read or hear about it. But, I don't have a whole lot of opinion on it. I find it fascinating. I've never come across any cases in New Hampshire that dealt with that, and I pretty much stick to New Hampshire and New England. So I find it fascinating, but I've never come across anything in New Hampshire along those lines.
Well, speaking of the New Hampshire, have you ever heard of any cattle mutilations?
That I have not.
Yeah. I know they're in a lot of places in the country. I have never actually heard of anything, anything close to New England myself. Someone out there may be listening and may tell me I'm totally wrong, but you just don't seem to hear that.
Yeah, it seems like it's more, Midwest farm country, although there are a lot of farms in New Hampshire, I don't know how much, cattle industry there is here, but that is a very interesting insight. I haven't really heard of any.
Now, have you heard of any UFO cases in this is also a message board question, in the Hampton Beach area?
Yes, there's been a good amount of, reports in and around Hampton over the years. Interestingly enough, the Exeter case, right as that was coming to an end, where the cops had gone back out to the field with Norman Muscarello and they witnessed the UFO themselves with Norman, they got back to the station and somebody had called the operator and claimed that some sort of red object was chasing them, and the phone went dead. And that call, I believe the call was put from Hampton Beach from a payphone. So that there's a little tie into the Exeter case, and there's been a number of things right around that area, because that's right outside of Exeter. So there have been a number.
Yes, yeah. I actually owned a property in Northampton, New Hampshire, for a number of years. So I do remember hearing some things going on, but it's funny, when we've talked about this before, when you may not have a sighting yourself, a lot of times there's no reason for you to really engage in this whole topic, but you'd hear things. I don't know about you, but I heard things over the years that sort of caught my interest. But until I had a sighting, I never really looked into the subject.
Yeah, it was the same way for me. I mean, I grew up watching Unsolved Mysteries and sightings and, those sort of shows that were on in the 80s that, would deal with UFOs to a certain degree. And so, I was always interested in that sort of thing. But, yeah, it wasn't until I had, my personal sighting that I really dove in.
Mm-hmm. And that doesn't happen to everyone. Sometimes people will have a sighting. And I would say probably, I would guess more than half or maybe less than half, but around that, who have a sighting that just write it off as something else and go on. When I had Dr. Seth Shostak from the SETI program on the show, he said, well, hey, I saw something really strange in the sky once. And sure enough, it was it ended up being a missile launch. And, so when someone like him has a sighting, he's going to look into it a lot more than the average person. And he certainly doesn't want to hear that there's UFOs, that's for sure.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, yeah, no, that's it's a good point. I mean, the more qualified the witness, if they're scientific-minded, they can, maybe do a bit more research or look into it more. But, on the same token, at least with the sighting that I had, and, I know with a lot of other people's sightings, sometimes there's characteristics of these things that really, they really point in the direction of something other than, earthly origin, mm-hmm. whether it be the speed or the flight characteristics. I mean, in my case, the object we saw exhibited what I now know as falling leaf motion, mm-hmm. which is a kind of a rocking or wobbling as it descends. Now, things like that, that's not a normal thing that something in the sky is going to exhibit. So, whether it's that or, something flying at a great rate of speed, these are the things that people like, Seth don't mention, that some UFO sightings, there are characteristics which, cannot be explained by, normal means. So, you know, yes, there are a lot of cases where somebody sees a light in the sky and, you know, it could have been a planet or, you know, the missile or whatever, but there are also a lot of cases, the good ones, where, you know, there are attributes that just, they don't point to terrestrial origin.
That's right. Yep. And, you know, there's two things you can think about that. Either just try to forget about what you saw. It's kind of, you know, I kind of liken it to ghosts. Now, I think that in my own humble opinion, I think that UFOs just seem a lot more solid than ghosts. But people see something. Something is going on. But a lot of times people, they just don't want to talk about it. Now, up on the message board, someone from Maine just... it's hard to see where it went. He had a sighting in Mechanics Falls, Maine, back in the fall of 2008. But that at that time, he says he didn't know where to report it. Now, I agree with you, Robert, on that statement, because when I had my sighting back in 2006, I had no idea how to report it. I called the police department. It just didn't occur to me to look anywhere online. And I think that may still happen to the average Joe out there who sees something. They don't know where to go with it.
I agree. You know, I agree. It was the same case for me. I didn't know anything about, you know, UFO research or even how to report one, you know, when I had my first sighting. So I didn't report it. I think it's a little easier now, you know, to find out. I mean, with the internet, it's a bit easier. But, yeah, it can be difficult. You know, to find where to report. But, you know, I find that these days, I mean, typically, you know, things get either reported to MUFON or the National UFO Reporting Center seem to be the, you know, the two places where people will report UFOs other than local police or military bases.
Yes. I tried years ago. I saw, I saw the most spectacular thing I ever saw, which was much better than the UFO I saw. And that is, I saw this big, huge fireball.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't know how to report it. I called Pease Air Force Base.
Oh.
And they were actually, you know, this was, 30 years ago, and they were actually quite nice.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, they didn't, there was no, like, ridicule factor. Like, the police department gave me the total ridicule runaround thing.
Well, that's good. That's good that they took it serious. They should, you know.
And a lot of
emergency.
A lot of things that people don't realize out there. If you had a sighting and it was several years ago, you can still report it.
You know, oh, definitely.
MUFON will still take cases.
It's funny that you say that, because I've noticed lately, you know, when I do go on MUFON's site, is that there are a lot of older cases being reported now, you know, from 60s, 70s, even early, you know, 2000s. So it does seem like there is an influx of people reporting older cases. So, that you know, that's it's good, and it's worth it, because... You know, some researcher or somebody could later correlate it to another sighting, you know, or so it's worth it to report, you know, even for that, just to have it on record, because, you know, then that's how patterns emerge, you know. So mm-hmm. I definitely think it's, you know, it's good to at least get the report out there. That way researchers have the information, and, you know, if it warrants investigation, then somebody can investigate it.
Yes, we had someone from Texas was listening to our show back when Roger Marsh was on a few weeks ago, from MUFON, and they went on and on about this sighting. Actually, the woman's son had. She's probably listening to the show, or will be. And Roger and her ended up connecting with the son, and, you know, that's going to be reported now in Texas.
Great.
And that was, I think, several years ago. So, yeah, it's a good thing, because, like you just mentioned, you know, that a lot of times it'll help connect the dots.
Definitely, you know, it could be, you know, a piece that, you know, links two things together, you know, so it's definitely good to get the info out there.
Right. So we got about eight minutes or so, you know, and I was just before the show, I was a little bit late getting to my desk here, and you and I had talked about some topics, and, you know, Ryan, I got to say, I forgot... I forgot the topics. If there's some you can think of.
Let me think of what we mentioned. I think we covered most of it. But, you know, I could kind of go off of what we were just talking about. You know, as far as reporting stuff, you know, it's really good for people to report stuff, but, you know, then it gets to, you know, one of the critiques that people make of MUFON, where, you know, things are being investigated and information is being, you know, gathered, but, you know, what is happening with it after? What, you know, what is being done with it? Is the data being crunched, you know? So, you know, I think it's good for people to report stuff, you know, but then at the same token, I think, you know, one thing ufology as a whole could do better is, you know, taking that data and you know, crunching it. It makes me think, you know, I've been reading Forbidden Science, Jacques Vallée, and, mm-hmm. you know, he was the first one to do computer categorization of UFO sightings, and he was doing it back when the IBM computers were the size of a room and you had to use punch cards to enter the information. And, you know, for that was like the early 60s, I believe. And then to be here now, and, you know, there's been so many great researchers that have spent, you know, decades gathering files or, you know, cases. And then a lot of times this stuff, you know, just kind of ends up in a warehouse or, you know, will be absorbed by another UFO organization. But I think, you know, one thing that's important is at some point, you know, it's going to be good to start trying to look at that stuff a bit more and, you know, try and actually glean some information from it.
You know, you look at sites like Peter Davenport's site. You know, he's a one-man show, and he gets, I think, hundreds of reports come into him per month. And, you know, I just wonder what happens to that data as well and, you know, what he does with it.
Well, the good thing, you know, the thing, I mean, pretty much most of the info, I mean, he posts it all right up on there, you know, other than, you know, obviously people's names and stuff. So, yeah, you know, I think it would be great to see, you know, these, I think, are the sort of projects that people can get involved in that want to do scientific-minded work in ufology. Maybe approach Peter Davenport about trying to do some computer analysis of his data, or, you know, same thing with MUFON, maybe start taking some of the stuff that has accumulated since 1969 and, you know, put it in a computer, approach it with some science, take a look at it, you know. So, and that's, you know, that's why I want to really try and get, you know, a research website built. That way all the cool things that I've uncovered, you know, over the past 15 years, they're going to be there for the next person that's interested in it. So, you know, they can use it as a stepping stone. They don't have to spend the years going around and, you know, digging for all this stuff. They can kind of take it from there and take it to a different place. So, you know, I hope, I'd like to see more of that going on.
Yeah, that's right. And that's a good point. He puts things up on his site. It's available. And I have talked at great length with another researcher in Texas, basically. And, you know, he's been discouraged because he knew something about, quite a bit about a particular case, knew people involved in it, had interviewed the people involved in it. And all he wanted was to get MUFON to give his name and number for the person involved that filled out a report, just to contact him if they wanted to. Sort of like we were talking about earlier, connecting some dots on a certain case, and, you know, MUFON would have no part of it. You know, I understand them being really protective. That's important. But there's also, you know, sometimes you need a little flexibility if it's going to, you know, help solve a case.
I agree. I think that, you know, that's another topic, you know, people trying to work together, you know, in ufology. I think, you know, that's something that could improve. But at the same time, when somebody's working on, you know, an original piece of research, I think it's important, you know, for them to be ready to share it, you know, before they do. But, you know, in a situation like that, you know, there's no reason that MUFON can't go to that person, say, look, there's somebody who wants to talk to you. We would not give them your identity unless we had your permission, you know. Send us your permission in writing and we can connect you, you know, something like that. But, you know, I think that, you know, there has been a lot of that with MUFON. You know, I think a lot of people have criticized them for, you know, kind of keeping their information to themselves. And, you know, the one particular case that, you know, I did an article about that was a alleged abduction in New Hampshire where MUFON investigated. The investigator would not reveal who the other investigators were with him. He claimed all this evidence, yet it was never scientifically examined or presented. So, you know, I've seen a little bit of that of myself, you know, with MUFON, and I think, you know, I think ultimately the more info they share with people and on their website, you know, obviously respecting people's privacy, the more they're going to get people excited about the subject, you know. So, you know, I think they maybe could do a little better at that.
You know, we have a situation here where we only got a couple minutes left, but you and I, you know, and one of our phone chats talked about it, and I'm not going to point any fingers, but there are a couple of people involved in MUFON. They're kind of whacked. I'm going to say it. You know, there's some really good people, you know, like Roger Marsh that was on our show. I thought he was really solid, but I hate to say it, but there's a couple of state directors that, in my humble opinion, should not be there representing MUFON.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, another thing, and, you know, obviously, I'm all of my critiques in MUFON, you know, are definitely, I mean them, constructive. And, you know, to what you just said, I think that's a good point, because what I find is there's a lot of inconsistency from maybe state to state or region to region with, you know, the quality of maybe the state directors or the sort of things that they're doing. So, you know, that's one thing that I've noticed, that I just think there's, you know, there's a lot of discrepancy there. And, you know, maybe that, you know, and also having studied the MUFON field manual, you know, there's a whole section about public relations in there. And, you know, some of the things, you know, I think maybe you're alluding to or, you know, things that come to mind, you know, there's people just, you know, kind of speaking out, and it's clear they're not taking, you know, MUFON as an organization maybe, and, you know, they're not taking that into consideration that they're speaking, you know, on behalf of an organization. So, you know, I've seen some of that, you know, before, and, you know, I think maybe, you know, that's just maybe they need to have more oversight. You know, maybe people are just allowed to, you know, I'm not really sure. I've never been a part of MUFON, so it's hard for me to comment, but, you know, I can only comment on what I've noticed, but, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it seems to be a stepping stone for some people, you know, and a lot of people are looked at more seriously, and they're in documentaries because they're part of a MUFON investigation. So it has to go with that. We only got a few seconds left, so why don't you throw out your website?
Sure. You can check out my website is www.NewHampshireUFOResearch.blogspot.com, and I will be working on the new website, and hopefully we'll have that up next year. And you can also check me out on Facebook, www.facebook.com/NewHampshireUFOResearch, and also on Twitter.
All right. So that's it for our show today. If you missed any part of the show, you can catch it as a podcast and a whole bunch of other podcasts on our website, which is podcastufo.com. I want to thank everyone for helping out with the show today. Our guest, Ryan Mullahy, Keith Rowland, producer for the Dark Matter Radio Network, Andy Fleming for Astronomy News, Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse for music, and Peggy Shunning for adminning our Facebook page. Next week, we have Nick Redford. Again, he's going to be on talking about his latest book, Close Encounters of the Fatal Kind. You could check us out right here on the Dark Matter Radio Network next week and every Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And that's it for our show. Thanks so much for listening. And remember, keep your eyes to the sky.